You're listening to the Humans of DevOps podcast, a podcast focused on advancing the humans of DevOps through skills, knowledge, ideas, and learning, or the SKIL framework.
If someone's having a particularly bad day, that's important context for their teammates to know as they're working with them. And not having the mental friction of having to put that down when you show up to work every day is a big part of avoiding burnout, of it being okay just to be a human at work.
Welcome to the Humans of DevOps podcast. I'm Evelyn Ehrlich, Chief Research Officer at DevOps Institute. Today, we have a very special guest. I'm very excited to introduce to you Nicholas Means. And he gave me the permission to call him Nick. So that's what actually I will do during our call and during our podcast. So let me introduce him quickly. So Nicholas is the VP of Engineering at SIM, S-Y-M. That's how it's spelled. That's the adaptive access tool built for developers. He's been an engineering leader for more than a decade, focused on helping teams build velocity through trust and autonomy. He also is a regular speaker at conferences around the world, teaching more effective software development practices through stories of real-world engineering triumphs and failures. And I was just listening to one of his talk, which we'll come to later on. So welcome, Nick, to our podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Evelyn. I'm so excited to be here.
Yes, I am excited to talk to you. And of course, we'll try to make it short and sweet so that our listeners can enjoy some of the learnings from you, because you have been, like in my introduction, a thought leader and a engineering leader. And that's really what the title today of the podcast is. It's Leading an Engineering Team Today, which I think is not easy. I'm sure it's fun, but that's really kind of at the core. But before we go there, let's start with SIM. Digging into SIM solution, I found this very interesting sentence: infrastructure needs to be secure, is something we all can agree on, but how to make that a reality is different. It's a very different hat. And this is where you guys at SIM have done some great invention and innovation. So tell us about SIM and what it does.
Yeah, absolutely. So SIM at its heart is a platform for creating access and approval workflows for production infrastructure, among other things. It lets you declare workflows in Terraform right alongside the rest of your infrastructure as code, lets you customize the logic using Python and then execute those workflows in Slack. And it's probably easiest to understand if I just tell you how we use SIM at SIM. Mm-hmm. We're still a small team. A lot of teams our size would probably still have pretty wide open system access. But because of some of the customers that we sell to and the kind of product we're building, that's not really an option for us. We're actually already SOC 2 Type 2 compliant. So part of how we accomplished that is putting a SIM workflow in place for accessing our own production infrastructure. So if an engineer on our team needs access to something in prod, they make that request in the Slack channel using the SIM bot, and then any of the other engineers on the team can peer approve that access for them. So it's kind of a two keys to launch the rocket approach to production access. And it works great, except in the middle of the night, because you don't want the on-call engineer to have to wake somebody else up just to get the access they need to troubleshoot. And so the way we've solved that, we have an SDK integration with PagerDuty. So we can tell if the person that's requesting that access in the middle of the night is also the on-call engineer. If they are, the system will automatically approve that access for them and let them access the production systems that they need. So they don't have to wake anybody up in the middle of the night to do it.
Very cool. Wow, that is very cool. Super duper. I used to be on this night call in many years ago. And of course, that is a great appreciation from my angle. If I would not have to be waking up, but at that time, we didn't have things like that. Super. Excellent. All right. So we do, for 5 years now, we have done research around skill building or upskilling, as we call it. And from this recent work, this we call the Upskilling IT 2023 research, it's based on survey of over more than 1,500 folks across different roles, developers, operations, et cetera, et cetera. We see significant gaps across a variety of skill domains, right? There are skill gaps, of course, around process skills. And again, is it DevOps? Is it ITIL? Is it SAFe? Is it Agile or Lean? IT for IT, all different kinds of process skills or technical skills. Those are the two top must-have or the areas where we see the biggest skill gaps, but also leadership and human skills right behind that. We also know that there are significant gaps across those leadership and human skills categories. And as you've been an engineering leader for more than a decade, I would love to quiz you on some of these different skill domains in specific leadership and human skills. So my first question is really around leadership skills in today's organizations and teams. What would you say are some best practices you have applied to lead a team of engineers today?
Yeah, it's a great question. Today is doing a lot of work in that question because it has changed. Leading engineering teams has changed a lot, especially over the last, year or two. Probably the most interesting trend is the shift to remote. Organizations that used to be in office are remote now. New companies that are forming are sort of remote by default in a lot of cases, just because of the shift in work practices that happened during the pandemic. And things that would be good leadership practices in an office setting become essential, when you're in that distributed context. And one of the first things on that list for me is trust. When your engineers are spread out all over the place, they're not in an office together, you lose the ability to kind of do the butt in seat management thing. You can't look around the office, see who's there, see who looks busy, and assume that you know what's going on with your team. And I think this is a good thing. But it's also a hard shift to navigate as a manager if you've been used to managing teams in an in-person setting. You have to be able to trust the people on your team to do work, and you have to be able to show them that they're trusted. Because a distributed team is by default going to have to operate in a more independent fashion than a team in an office. They're going to spend more time kind of on their own doing work. And then when you have a team of engineers that are working more independently, you have to spend more time as a leader building context. You mentioned in the intro that I do a lot of speaking. My talks are a little different than most in that they're primarily storytelling. I spend about 20 or 30 minutes telling a story and then draw a conclusion from it at the end, but most of it's storytelling. And that crosses over into my day-to-day work a lot as well. It's a pretty key tool in my toolbox around setting context for engineering teams, being able to tell the story of the organization, the story of our customers, the story of the feature that we're trying to build in a way that the engineers on the team can connect with it and work from it in an independent and autonomous fashion. That trust and autonomy, I think it's important because it goes a long way to helping engineers be happy and more satisfied in their work. It's one thing to pick cards off of an engineering backlog and do them and ship the code. And that's satisfying, but it's a whole different kind of satisfaction when you're able to take a problem that one of your organization's customers is experiencing, go from that problem statement to figuring out what the right solution in your platform would be, and to build that solution, and then to be able to put it in the hands of your customer and see the work that you've done impacting the way that they're able to do their work. So I'm always trying to find ways to connect that whole thread and help the team see the whole thread of the things that they're working on.
Mm-hmm. Great. So do you get feedback from the folks saying, hey, you are awesome, I appreciate this trust you give me? That's rewarding, I'm assuming, for you as a leader as well, right?
It's one of my favorite things. And it's one of the reasons that I've sort of grown to lead teams this way over time, because it is a lot more satisfying for me to be able to see my team build that kind of satisfaction and to achieve that kind of growth. I mean, one of the challenges and risks of leading this way is you have to be careful you're giving people the right amount of autonomy, and you're not asking them to kind of, if they've never been rock climbing before, you don't want to ask them to go climb the Dawn Wall. You want to give them a problem that's approachable.
Yeah. The sink or swim, right? Sink or swim approach. We've been through that in old styles of leadership. I remember leaders in my former life like that. Excellent. Great example. Great idea. Storytelling and, of course, trust and autonomy at the right level. Yeah, this situation with engineers being all over the world practical. Just spoke to one of the engineers who is leading a DevOps team who moved to some foreign island because he's a surfer and loves to work from there. And of course, his team is somewhere completely different in the time zone. And so he said to me, yes, my manager, my leader trusts me completely. I do. I feel great as part of that team. So evidence to that as well. Excellent. So let's shift on to the challenges. Leading teams of engineers, and not just engineers, of course, but we're focusing on engineers right now, doesn't come without challenges, right? Burnout, productivity issues are just a few, but I'm sure you've seen other challenges. So what challenges or problems have you seen as leader of engineering teams? And then, of course, how you address them? How do you solve them? And you can pick one or two, doesn't have to be, like I said, burnout or productivity. I'm sure you have other examples.
I actually love that you mentioned burnout, because that's been a pretty key focus of mine for myself and for the folks that I lead over the past couple years. The interesting dynamic that emerged sort of at the start and through COVID was life just got a lot harder across the board. There were a lot more things to think about. I mean, I distinctly remember at the start of the pandemic, going to the grocery store and facing a line to check out that stretched all the way to the back of the store. And that's something that I had never seen before. And everybody on my team was doing that. They were like, okay, I've got to go grocery shopping and it may take me all afternoon to do it. And I'm feeling slightly guilty about missing work. And it's sort of continued. I mean, there's, even as the pandemic has waned, I won't say it's over, but as it's waned, there are other concerns that have sort of stepped in around government and, you know, in the United States, some of the challenges around gender-affirming care that are experienced in some of the states. And so it feels like people just have a lot more on their mind and are having to juggle a lot more outside of work context in addition to the work that we're asking them to do as part of our companies. And so, you know, the challenge with that is, or the solution I found with that is just to be more comfortable with people bringing more of themselves to work. You know, it's tempting to tell people, okay, you're at work now, set that on the shelf. I need you to be productive. But that's not how humans work. And we all know it. We just like to pretend that that's not the way it actually is. But there's a lot of power in welcoming those feelings, welcoming those struggles, being able to talk about them in the work context, because they are context for the work that people are doing. If someone's having a particularly bad day because of things that they're seeing in the news cycle that particularly affect them, that's important context for their teammates to know as they're working with them that day. And not having the mental friction of having to put that down when you show up to work every day is a big part of avoiding burnout, I think. Mm-hmm. Of it being okay just to be a human at work.
Skill Up Days and Skill Up Hours are the perfect way to stay on top of the latest DevOps trends and improve your skills from the comfort of your own home or office. Our virtual micro-conferences and webinars focus on DevOps and the tech industry and feature expert speakers from both the DevOps world and top IT companies. At our Skill Up Days, you will get everything you'd expect at a traditional conference, including virtual sponsored booths, competitions, and networking opportunities with other attendees and speakers. Don't miss out. Check out our lineup of upcoming events on devopsinstitute.com and register now.
You know, this reminds me of, again, my earlier career. I started at a very large company as a support engineer. And I have to name the company because it's important, Hewlett Packard at the time. And Dave Packard and Bill Hewlett had a theme. It was for many, many, many things. It was called HP Way. And part of the HP Way was actually exactly that. And this goes back to, I started there in 83. So many, many years ago. And I actually met both of those gentlemen once. And yeah, unbelievable. I still am very, very, feel myself very lucky that I have met those two gentlemen. But in that HP Way, it was addressed exactly that, to bring yourself into the company. And I think it was Dave who was telling a story at one of those coffee talks. And he said, he went up to an engineer and he said, why do you leave? I watch your car every morning. I park next to your car and you leave the car window open, slightly open. Why do you leave it open? Because it's raining, right? This Palo Alto, it rains. Mm-hmm. And the gentleman said, so that my personality wouldn't suffocate in the car. And that was, everybody was laughing about that, but that individual obviously did not want to bring his personality in and left his humanity in the car. You know, I thought that was really funny. It matches really exactly what you're saying, having that human. And that's for us at DevOps Institute is very important. And that fits actually with my next thought and my next topic. Again, in the research we did, I was blown away that collaboration and coordination is still the biggest skill gap across these organizations who answered, or these individuals who answered. So from the research, we found 35% when we asked them, what are your top three gaps in human skills? And the first one was collaboration and cooperation with 35%. The second one was creativity and entrepreneurship. And then the third was diversity and inclusion, right? I'm not surprised on the diversity and inclusion. We have made a lot of progress, but collaboration and cooperation after so many years and after so much of work. So here my question, in your opinion, why is it so difficult to get people to collaborate and to cooperate? Because, I mean, we all are working on goals, should be thinking we're working together on goals, but why is it so difficult?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, the survey results that you just cited. I think a lot of the reason all three of those are lacking in a lot of organizations kind of comes down to the same root cause, and that's lack of safety. You have to build for all three of those things to be possible: collaboration, ownership, inclusivity. There needs to be a foundation of deep psychological safety that's a part of any team that's going to have those things as an attribute, those skills present in the work that they do. It's really hard to collaborate when you're also competing for a promotion. And that's the thing that's in the forefront of your mind. There's this zero-sum mm-hmm. game that you're playing. You're trying to climb a ladder. You don't feel very safe. You can't say, I don't know. You can't ask for help. You have to always look like you have it put together in order to keep climbing that ladder. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the how to crash a plane talk. One of the fascinating dynamics there. So that talk was about United Flight 232, which was a flight that sort of crash landed in Sioux City, Iowa. Had a lot better. The tail engine fan disc exploded, lost all of its hydraulics, but they managed to get the plane to an airport and onto the ground in a relatively controlled fashion for a plane that had no hydraulics. And it had a lot better outcome than it probably could have. In fact, they tried to do it in simulators afterwards, and none of the crews that tried to pilot a plane that was set up in a similar configuration in a simulator could come anywhere close to the outcome that flight crew managed to get. Well, when you start digging into why that is, this was sort of right after crew resource management or cockpit resource management became an important part of aviation. And it's this idea that in the cockpit, you're in a life or death situation because you have to pilot this plane safely. And in that situation, you should use all of your resources at your disposal to do that. You know, prior to cockpit resource management becoming a part of aviation, there were all these incidents where the captain's word would go and the captain would sort of shut down the rest of the flight crew, or they wouldn't feel comfortable challenging him even when they saw a problem. They wouldn't want to point it out. Mm-hmm. And I use the word him pretty deliberately there because most pilots back then were men. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's been a challenge for the aviation industry to build crew resource management into the way that they work. It's an ongoing thing that flight crews still work on, still receive training on. But the key idea behind it is that everybody in the cockpit gets a voice. Everybody that's participating in the situation has a right to speak up, to talk about what they see, to point out what they're seeing. And the same sort of ideas translate to engineering teams. It's pretty easy in an engineering team for one person on the team to have the dominant voice and to kind of force their will upon everybody else on the team. They're used to their voice being the default, their viewpoint being the one that's the most important. And that's a really difficult, if you're in that situation, it's really difficult to want to collaborate or cooperate or to even find the room to be able to do it. Whereas if you have a team where everybody is seeking to make room for everybody else, everybody is seeking to empower everybody else, everybody wants everybody else to succeed. And as a leader of that team, you're incentivizing that kind of behavior. You're rewarding people for that kind of behavior. Then you see things, you see behaviors start to emerge from the team that you wouldn't see in the absence of that safety and that invitation to participate.
Beautiful. We should think about a blog on that, the lack of safety, or actually the inspiration, give inspiration to ensuring that there is that safety feeling. It makes me think of my two daughters. Both of them just started their careers. One is an architect, the other one is an analyst in customer experience. And my architect, she is in a, even so, it's a women-led company, but there is a lot of, let's say, older architects, and they're male. Mm-hmm. And so she just sent me a text yesterday. She's supposed to do a presentation today on sustainability, and she is all worried about, because there's going to be a whole bunch of guys in the team, and they all are thinking and are very overwhelming. And I didn't know what to tell her. She said, "Mom, what, how?" I of course, I said, "Yeah, you're good, you know, enforcing that she has the skills. And if you don't know, then ask the questions. And if they ask you a question and you don't know the answer, say just you don't know the answer. Don't BS them." But that was shocking to me that she is so scared, even though she's now there for a year and a half. Obviously, in that organization, they don't have that safety net or that feeling of safety. So that's a great blog we should collaborate on. Super. Great idea. Let's do that. All right. We are lacking technical skills. I'm sure you guys have challenges finding good engineers or skilled engineers, right? And we do know and see, and again, this is from the same research, upskilling and learning initiatives and so on. But I'm curious on, and we talked a little bit about this at the beginning, I'm curious on your thoughts around an effective and a successful upskilling or skill building path. Let me share with you what we found from our research. So we asked the question, what are the top three upskilling frameworks, or how do you like to learn in the IT organization? So 48% said they like to do virtual learning, online events, conferences, classes, self-study, blah, blah, blah. In-person learning kind of goes along with that, depending on right where you are and how far and how much budget you have. But then the next one is peer learning, buddying, workflow, shadowing, pair programming, and things like that. That's 40%. Then expert coaching, leader coaching, manager coaching, and then experiential learning. It's about 31%. And then there were 20%. I can't believe that. We're doing field work. Maybe they didn't think, maybe I'm thinking of field work or something different. I called it the sink or swim model, but 20% are preferring that. I was like, what? Did they not read the survey correctly? Anyway, my question for you, what has worked for what you have seen in terms of skill creation and upskilling and learning path in all of those things? What do you guys apply when you bring in new engineers, or what do you see with your customers?
Yeah, it's interesting. Again, I think, you know, the shift to remote work that we're seeing definitely plays into this and changes some of the learning modalities that work best for a team. There's sort of this common wisdom that you can't be a successful new engineer in a remote organization. And I've not found that to be the case. I've actually seen some folks come straight out of boot camp into remote organizations and do great. But it was because that organization spent a lot of time in that third category that you talked about, the peer learning, buddying, pair programming. It takes, again, going back to safety, it takes a safe organization to be able to pull that off. for somebody who's new to their career to be able to come in and feel safe enough saying, I don't know, over and over again, and sitting with a more senior engineer and letting that senior engineer kind of be the navigator in that pair and let them kind of fumble their way around and unstick them every once in a while. And it can feel, if you don't think about it the right way, it can feel like an inefficient use of that senior engineer's time. But if you think of it in terms of an investment in upskilling the newer engineer, it makes perfect sense to spend time that way. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I've had a bunch of conversations with folks that are in that position where they're the more senior engineer, they're navigating in a pair, they're helping a newer engineer come up to speed and helping them reframe what they're looking for in that pairing session. Yeah, of course you want to get the task done. You want to get the code shipped, but you're also going to have to find some satisfaction in watching that other person learn, or you're going to get really impatient and you're not going to let them do the learning that they need to do. So that's probably my biggest strategy in this regard. I don't know. I think we tend to overemphasize this a little bit in the technology world. The idea that someone is technically skilled enough to do the job. I think most people that gravitate towards this kind of career are technically skilled enough and sharp enough to figure it out. And if you give them the resources, they're going to be able to navigate that. And we don't spend a whole lot of time in the hiring process screening for collaboration, screening for ability to work together, screening for ability to be a good peer on an engineering team. And that's part of what creates that culture of safety in the first place, where somebody can learn and grow and take advantage of opportunities that are just slightly outside their comfort zone.
I am sometimes amazed looking at the different job descriptions, because skill research is what I do, and whatever Indeed or LinkedIn or wherever, I look at many of these job descriptions for DevOps engineers, automation engineers, developers, whatever, and I'm absolutely amazed at the lack of this human skills requirements that put in there. It's like, okay, you have to know Python and you have to know that and all of that and all of that. I'm sure these folks have, right? They that's what they do. That's why they're in the job. They love this type of stuff. Why don't they have other requirements? And I think until it is that way that we have those types of things as a must, it will be a challenge. And for those who are here, like yourself, leaders to look up to, it's hard work for you. It's hard work to cast that shadow of such a leader, but they're not enough. And I think that's a challenge. And for us at the DevOps Institute, we need to shift into that human upskilling as well. But that's also hard, right? Because how do you do that? How do you do that? That's a question for next time. Go ahead.
It's really hard. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it sort of gets back to, what do we incentivize?
Yep.
You know, are we rewarding people for shipping big marquee features? Or are we rewarding people for making an entire team more efficient by the influence that they have on that team? We should reward both, but we often don't reward the person that does that second job.
Exactly. Absolutely. Well said. Fantastic. Well, I have one more question and has nothing to do. Well, maybe, I'm not sure. My closing question: what do you do for fun?
It's funny. So recently I have been picking piano back up. I played piano as a kid and then quit in, I think, when I was about 10 or 11, and haven't played since. And I've been learning to play piano again. I've actually got one in my office here sitting right behind me. And I love it because I'm good enough now that I've got some songs that are fun to play, that I enjoy playing, and I can go sit down at the piano, and it sort of shifts me out of thinking of whatever problem it is I'm trying to think through. It'll move that problem into my subconscious because I'm focusing on playing the piano, and I'll emerge from playing the piano 15 or 20 minutes, and my brain has figured out what to do about the situation that I was thinking about before I sat down to play.
Ah.
I didn't expect that when I started taking piano back up. I felt sad that I didn't know how to play piano anymore, but that's been a really fun thing to realize.
So double whammy, double win for you. Excellent. Yeah. That is fantastic. I'm jealous. I'm too old to learn it. I have a guitar. I played it. It's behind me. Maybe I should take your advice and do the same thing. Stop the meeting, stop thinking, play a few tunes, practice. I will do that. I will let you know how it turns out. Super.
Yeah, please do.
This has been great, Nick. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. Thank you for the great advice, for some great coaching. And I hope our listeners enjoyed that very, very much, what you had to say. So again, thank you. We've been talking to Nicholas Means, VP of Engineering at SIM, S-Y-M. Check it out. And if you have a chance, check out the How to Crash an Airplane, which you mentioned, Nick. It's the crew resource management and a lot of work. A great story. I loved the YouTube. It's on YouTube on United Airlines 232 DC-10 crash. Sad, but it's also very, very good because it has a lot of things. Again, Nicholas, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, Evelyn. It's been a great conversation.
Humans of DevOps podcast is produced by DevOps Institute. Our audio production team includes Julia Pape, Daniel Newman-Schultz, and Brendan Lay. Shout out to my wonderful colleagues who make this sound even better when they're done with it. I'm Humans of DevOps podcast executive producer, Evelyn Ehrlich. If you would like to join us on the podcast, please contact us at humansofdevopspodcast@devopsinstitute.com. And I did not make a mistake saying that. I'm Evelyn Ehrlich. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. Don't forget to join our global community to get access to even more great resources like this. Until next time, remember, you are part of something bigger than yourself. You belong.